most don't. State of Texas, killing machines. Don't you know they're killing people?
Michael Lynn Riley has been a prisoner in Texas for 23 years. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Michael Lynn Riley today on Malcolm X's birthday in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Esther King, a founder of the SHAPE Community Center in Houston's Third Ward. The Execution Watch begins.
And indeed, we have begun. And so this is Ray Hill, and thank you, Elizabeth, for giving us off to a good start. This is a very interesting case to me in that I received a letter from Michael Riley on the sixth day of this month, which is unusual. This is the first time I've had any communication with somebody that we were scheduling Execution Watch show. In the letter, he brings up several issues. Among them was treatment of people on death row. So as we do this show, Tachin Prayer, Hank Skinner, Rob Will, and Mark Stroman are all on a hunger strike on death row because of treatment conditions there that would remind you of the Abu Ghraib, the discussion going on the major media about torture and other things. But tonight, we're facing the very serious situation that Mr. Riley is scheduled to be executed tonight. And so Elizabeth is getting in touch with the vigilance up there. But while that is going on, we have Jim Skelton in the studio with us. Jim, you said earlier that told me in the lobby that this case probably wouldn't be tried as a capital case today.
Probably not, because it really is, and I hate to say the word, a kind of a garden variety robbery. Excuse me. The only thing that makes it particularly bad is that he went to a convenience store and robbed and stabbed a lady in the back, but stabbed her 31 times. The number of times that he stabbed her may be enough to qualify as a death penalty. He had been in the penitentiary on two different occasions, had been arrested a great deal, apparently had a lot of trouble growing up because he had a rather long criminal record. And apparently all the police officers, probation officers, and judges he appeared before all testified he had a reputation for being violent. But today we've had the instances where people have broke in, for example, in the same area around Dallas, and kill two people, including a pregnant woman. They didn't seek the death penalty. Mm. So I think in today's climate, this probably wouldn't be a death penalty case.
Glory, are you there?
Yes, I'm here in Huntsville.
What's going on, darling?
What's going on is that the media went in, the witnesses have gone in, and the execution is taking place. Michael Riley, who his friends call Fleetwood, has Irene Wilcox, who's one of the prison chaplains, or not a chaplain, she's a minister.
Yeah.
Witnessing, along with his brother, and then a friend of his from McKinney, Texas, named Kay. Is that her name? Kay Leonard from McKinney, Texas. She's with it. There's two of her friends out here with me. Their church writes to people on death row. They have pen pals, and she went in to witness to be with him.
You got a crowd there?
Oh, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven of us.
Seven of you?
Uh-huh.
Beautiful day.
Beautiful day.
Sad occasion. Sad occasion. A beautiful day.
It is, because, you know, Michael Riley's been on death row 25 years, and he is not the same person that committed a horrible crime all those years ago in Quitman.
Yeah.
And he not only has a large, loving family, but he has quite a circle of friends that are very close to him. When I was visiting at death row Friday, that was the first day of his 2 days of eight-hour visits, and people were in and out and in and out. People he'd gone to school with, family members. He has a number of friends in Europe. In fact, as we're speaking, it must be late at night in Switzerland, but they are digging a hole and planting a tree as we talk to remember Michael by. So, and the guys on death row, since he's been there so long, he's considered one of the old men.
Yeah.
But he was obviously very much loved by the men on death row.
Yeah, he wrote me a letter this month, and I read the poem earlier on the prison
show. Oh, you did?
And I'll probably read it tonight if we have time. But the process has begun, and keep us posted.
Okay, and I just wanted to say, you know, it's so, I don't know if ironic is the right word, but that on Malcolm X's birthday, a black man is being put to death by the state of Texas.
And we have Esther King in the studio to talk about that.
Oh, okay. And also, I wanted to remind people that a little later, at 7 o'clock tonight, there's going to be a meeting at Shape Center on prisons. And the featured speaker is Michael Bell, one of the Gina Six. So this is his first time ever to speak in public.
Okay, darling. We love you. Keep us posted. And that was Gloria Rubeck of the Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And she is before Huntsville State Penitentiary, where the death house is located. Jim, let's continue.
Okay, now what had happened, as I said earlier, he was a 28-year-old man. And on the way, this convenience store picked up a butcher knife, and then when the clerk turned her back, he started stabbing her and killed her. And here's kind of the crazy thing about it. After he killed her, he left the store, and then went back that afternoon and talked to the sheriff's department and told them that he knew something about the murder. Mm. And of course, they finally put him at the store and began to quiz him, and sure enough, he finally ended up confessing. They found clothing with the money in it, and found blood leading him to it, found footprints where he's outside the store. They found a lot of evidence linking him to it. I don't think there ever has been a serious question about him being committing the crime. I think even in the letters to you, he's admitted it. And what happened at the punishment hearing, he'd been arrested something like 18 times prior to this particular case. Had been in the penitentiary on two different occasions for burglary, had been out of jail for burglaries. And so what happened, the reason he's been on death row so long, his initial death penalty case was reversed with the Court of Criminal Appeals because they messed up in jury selection. The trial judge excused the jury he claimed was vacillating on the death penalty, when in fact all she said was, I have moral scruples against the death penalty, but I could answer the special issues based on the evidence. And they said that's not vacillating, so they reversed it. Retried him a second time, he got a second death penalty, so 24 people voted that he should die. And then what happened, he started working his way through the federal system and the state system, and really the only issue they ever argued. In his first trial, there was evidence that his IQ was 63 when he was sent to Terrell State School. This is on one of his many incarcerations. And that was brought up at the punishment hearing in the first trial. Well, at the second trial, they did not bring up the issue of mental retardation. That was the basis of the federal writ. He claimed his lawyer in the second trial should have used mental retardation as some sort of defense. But what happened, the lawyer said that he was aware of the fact that he had scored a 63 earlier. But in his opinion, based upon talking to Mr. Riley, based on talking to his family, he didn't think he was mentally retarded. Plus, those of us who try cases realize the danger of that sort of testimony, because you say a man has stabbed a woman 31 times, and you want to show he's rehabilitated. Well, if by the same token you prove he's mentally retarded, you generally don't get better as time goes on. As I've often said, the only cure for mental retardation is like somebody a judge, and that cures them. But it's no short of that, he's going to be mental retarded. So that when you introduce that evidence, you're also giving incentive for a jury to want to execute somebody, because the theory is, it's kind of like the argument, I've got a dog that kills my sheep, and I love my dog, but I can't afford to lose my sheep, and the dog's not getting any better, he's a sheep killer, therefore we've got to protect the sheep. And so the lawyer decided as a part of trial strategy not to use mental retardation because he didn't think he was mentally retarded. Because apparently Mr. Riley was able to help his lawyer during the case, helped him during voir dire, helped him select on who should be on the jury. And what he did do is hire a psychologist to examine Mr. Riley. This was the second trial. And to determine whether or not they thought he'd be a future danger. But again, on the second to go around, they gave him the death penalty. And then, of course, after that, the Atkins decision came down that said you could say violates the Sixth and Eighth Amendment to execute a mentally retarded person. But that barrier they raised is so high, just the fact that he had an IQ of 63 12 years ago doesn't qualify him under Atkins, because Atkins, you've got to have an IQ of 60 or below, or 65 or below, starting at childhood and lack of adaptive behavior and the several hoops you got to go through. So what happened in the federal system and later on in the state system, he claimed mental retardation under Atkins, claimed his law was ineffective. All of that was eventually overruled. The Fifth Circuit overruled all of that, as well as the federal district court, as did all the state courts. And that was really the only issues on appeal.
Now, we almost had an execution here more recently, and we got a last-minute stay. What was that about?
The last-minute stay? I think that was over a Batson issue, if I recall. A Batson issue is when they have racial discrimination in selecting a jury, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, well, we geared up to take this
right
to show, and then we wound up with the thing.
Right.
But there's nothing really. His lawyers were adequate.
Well, see, these are real tough decisions. You know, you're sitting in a jury box, and this is being tried in North Texas in a rural area.
Sure.
And you've got an African-American who's killed a woman that's working at a store, and it's a pretty bad stabbing. And then do you or do you not bring up evidence of somebody being slower, mentally ill, mentally retarded? Because, see, that cuts two ways. It can be sympathetic, but by the same token, it cuts the other way. It doesn't send it for the jury to want to execute somebody. And that's a tough decision for a lawyer to have to make. And I think what happened in this case, a lawyer was able to communicate with him, Mr. Riley's able to talk to him, able to help him. And I thought the jury would think the same thing that he thought, that he wasn't that mentally retarded. And sometimes, folks, you know, when someone has mental illness, except for women, women the exception to the rule, they're pretty lenient about women. But when it comes to men, that dog doesn't hunt. That's a real difficult thing to sell to a jury, especially when you have a stabbing of a woman and that many stab wounds inflicted.
You know, if we had the ability to take the clock, make it go the other direction, and the calendar, put more pages on top instead of tearing them off, throwing them away. And we went back to the juvenile problems he was having, and the early criminal history. If somebody had intervened at that point.
Let me tell you something I think we should do, and this has always annoyed me. We have no problem when a juvenile commits a crime and he's above the age of 14. We think he's mentally and psychologically an adult. We can certify him over to district court. What it seems to me that reverse should be just as applicable. If an adult who is mentally retarded or has some type of birth defect hasn't got the IQ and maturity of an adult, he should be certified back to juvenile court and treated in the same way a juvenile is treated. It just seems kind of quid pro quo. I've never understood that, because one of the most difficult things in criminal law, I remember a kiddo that was injured at birth, and he had a mind of a 7-year-old, but the hormones of an 18-year-old man.
Oh, yeah, sure. I know.
And you know, that's horrible, because you've got a 7-year-old mind trying to control the urges of an 18-year-old body. And that's there's no answer to that. I mean, that's an absolute total nightmare. There's no way to cure that, because you can't cure the hormones and you can't make them any smarter. And one of the worst failing of our system is how we treat the mentally ill. And especially mentally ill if you happen to be an African-American or Hispanic or not a color of white. Now, we're trying to recognize that, because now we're starting some mental health courts. We're slowly kind of catching up with that.
That's brand new.
But that's all brand new. And we have that kind of redneck mentality. We've had it for years in Texas about, you know, oh, he just says he's crazy, that sort of stuff. And we've had that kind of redneck mentality about people with mental illness. And a vast number of people in our system are simply mentally ill. And they're, like I say, they're not going to get any better the way we've been treating them.
But you know, even someone with an IQ of 63, those folks are, for the most part, trainable. We have a lot of people with an IQ of 63 that are able to get up and get dressed and go flip hamburgers or do some kind of work in the society and be reasonably self-sustaining. But if we don't take the time to do that, if all we do is ignore that, then a track of criminal behavior that gets increasingly violent sets in. There is a societal conviction here. And that societal conviction is, if we had taken Michael Riley when he started misbehaving, had plenty of cops to come up and testify that he was all these bad guys and all of that, Well, if those cops, and in that mix of cops, there had been somebody that actually cared about Michael Riley, they could have trained him to live a better life without serial misbehavior.
Another thing, too, Ray, that no one's ever talked about very much, these IQ tests are slanted because it's kind of a white cultural thing, and I think a lot of people that are member of minority groups who have a different vocabulary, different way of looking at things. Like, I remember years ago reading a deal where a guy said all an IQ test is a test designed by psychologists to prove that they're smart and the farmers are idiots. Now, farmers had written the test. The farmers would be the geniuses and the psychologists would be the idiots. Well, you take these kiddos that are raised kind of in broken homes that come from minority families. I'm trying to be judgmental, but a lot of the way they think is a little bit different than ours. Not that one's better than the other, it's just different. But these are tests designed by white culture, and I'm not too sure it's a real accurate representation of when it tests a lot of minority children, including Hispanics who have a language problem, including a lot of African Americans. I'm not too sure 63 is an accurate measure of his intellect. Even sure. I think he was probably brighter than that, because obviously he could help his lawyer during the trial.
Why don't we take just a minute here and allow the audience to listen to Michael Riley's
sure.
own writing, because Michael Riley wrote me this month, and in this writing he wrote a poem. Now, I'm going to correct some of the syntax problem and some of the spelling in order to read this program. Reflections of My Past, Michael Riley. It has been 22 years and counting since I left the free world, when I had lived in the world acting a fool in every way. I just couldn't lay down my life of deadly destruction, not that I tried to, for I was filled with corruption. My God was dice and gambling and women, which I worshipped and cherished. My friend was money and good drink I nourish. My family tried to help me. They always showered me with their love. God, I just can't believe what a fool I once was. But it's been 22 years and counting since I robbed and killed, taking something that wasn't mine. So they sent me down to death row to be executed. Oh, what I would give if I could take it all back, to start my life over. But it won't cut me no slack. So I sit here in prison behind cold doors and bars of steel, dreaming of freedom and how it must feel. I had to learn the hard way, but least I can finally see that doing things that I did wasn't happiness, because it took the world from me. But by coming here, I found the Lord, which I thought might be late, but without him, I would be empty and filled with bitter hate. I prayed that I don't go crazy while here, for so many do, because time is like a guillotine, it can cut your mind in two. So I'll wake up every morning and ask the Lord above to give me the strength to keep on going, and I ask him for his love. Well, my time is on this side of life might be coming to an end. It's all in the hands of the Supreme Court here and God above. If things don't work out for me on this side, please don't forget, I love you so. Michael Riley. I got the letter on May the 6th of this year. He is in the process of being executed. Gloria is going to notify us when the witnesses are released, and I use sterile terms for this. The process will have been completed, because it's a ritual. We've got in the studio Esther King, and Esther King and I go way, way back. Esther, what are your thoughts?
Ray, the whole question of whether whatever crime someone is convicted of is worthy of that person being put to death is a kind of a complex question in this society. Has historical implications. Of course, it has the racial overtone, especially here in the South. But, you know, I think first, on the level of the fact that there are people who will quickly say, and these people are on juries, and usually they are their feelings are manipulated. There are people who say, well, if you kill somebody, that's the ultimate and you should die. Well, society will place a gun in your hand, identify an enemy, usually abroad, and give you medals for killing.
Mm-hmm.
So just the question of having taken a life then has to be looked at in the fullest sense.
Relatively few homicides become capital cases.
Exactly. And so that notion that, if we institute capital punishment as a remedy for capital crimes or for killing, you know, whether it's for monetary reasons and passion or whatever, it's going to slow down or stop the incidents. That's been proven not to be the case. So still the states, the politicians, and everybody who call for it really base their appeal now strictly on revenge.
Now, Esther, you and I have been all over the board on this one.
Right.
Remember Clarence?
Sure.
Clarence literally didn't do it.
Right, sure.
And they were damn sure.
And came very close.
Damn sure going to kill. Yeah. I remember Ozell dressed up in a suit and a tie to come down here talk on the radio.
Sure.
To talk about his brother and the Shape Center and I and all of us pitched in and did that. And then we have seen other people executed.
Sure.
That didn't do it.
Right.
Or in my opinion, didn't do it. And with insufficient evidence. So, you know, it boils down to what value you're going to place on life anyhow.
Exactly. And who has the moral authority to make that decision in terms of, you know, when the prosecutor decides to say this is a capital case and this is not a capital case, and then places that decision in the juror's hand. And say that, you know, you fellow citizens stand in judgment of this individual and you decide after conviction whether this person lives or dies. But, and I go back to issues that Attorney Skelton has raised in terms of, and the thing that you raise, we, you know, with the society, the inequities in society, the way that many young people are having to be brought up, I can almost sometimes look at some youngsters and say with pretty good assurance that they're going to TDC. I mean, here
okay.
they are, 5 or 6 years old.
Hold up, Esther, sure. Because we've got Glory on the phone. Glory, you can hear Esther's booming voice.
Yes, I can.
Okay, sister, what's going on?
Well, the execution of Michael Riley has taken place. His brother and his friends just walked across the street. And they are now victims of the state of Texas. I'm looking at all these guards out here today. I wonder if it's probably an accident, but besides the big shot mobile command center that's here, all of the guards standing out here are African American. And they all know that they're standing out here because a black man was executed on Malcolm's birthday.
Okay, let me tell the audience something that's going to happen right now. The process of taking care of Michael Riley's body is it was before he was executed. There was someone from Huntsville Funeral Home there to recover the body after the execution. And now the family has got a very small window of time to go after witnessing the execution to the funeral home and touch their now dead loved one while there's still warmth in the body. And there's just something really morbid about that, but I understand why the families need to do that.
Huh?
I understand why the families need to go feel that warmth, because they haven't been allowed to touch them for 23
yeah.
years.
In this case, 25 years.
Yeah. And so I can understand that, but that you know, I when I first heard of that, I thought, how do I deal with this? Well, the way I deal with it is that I put it on the microphone because I can't ignore it.
No, and it actually is relative. I mean, I've been over there a good half a dozen times and held somebody's hand who's just been executed and watched their wife caress their face and kiss them.
Yes.
So it's when Joseph Nichols was executed, there must have been 30 or 40 of his family members at the Huntsville funeral home.
Well, Gloria, you can, while we've got Esther in here, you and he can have a conversation.
You know, Gloria, the death penalty, as we know it, even here in Texas, is going to pass from usage one day. And people way down the road are going to look back and wonder, how did, you know, there are countries in Europe who have not done that for a very long time. Uh-huh. And I'm sure that some people have that conversation. How could we do that? And that's going to take place in this country. Way down the road, people are going to say, how could people do that?
Belgium hasn't done it for 1,300 years.
Right. And and I'm sure even the family members of the victims of crimes, when actually the person executed was guilty of whatever the crime was, even those people certainly can't take satisfaction after the fact. And given the process of the time between conviction and execution, everybody knows that the person being executed is not the person who was convicted. That's not the same
person. They never convict the same person.
It's not the
same
person.
They called him Fleetwood. All of the people I've talked to said that he's just an incredible, very nice, loving man. And so, no, he's not the stupid kid he was when he was 18 or 19 or however old he was. He's been on death row 26 years.
I've heard wardens make that statement. I've heard wardens being interviewed saying that the person that was executed was not the person that came into prison.
No, I think that, as a matter of fact, Warden Willett makes a big point of that in his book. And Warden Willett was executioner for George W. Bush, so he was a busy man.
Sure.
Gloria, this is the 199th execution.
Correct, under Governor Perry.
Under Governor Perry. I understand that the abolition movement is planning some kind of event around the 200th. Would you tell us about it?
The 200th execution will take place on June 2nd, and we will be going to the old hanging tree in downtown Houston where people were lynched, and we will be protesting the legal lynchings that are taking place in Huntsville. And there's going to be... in fact, I just talked to some of Michael Riley's friends that are out here. They said that they're going to have a 200th protest in Dallas, and there's going to be one in Austin, and there's going to be one in the Rio Grande Valley, and there's going to be one even in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So,
You know, 200 executions during a single governor's term is unprecedented.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Governor... when Bush was governor, he had set the record for 152, but Perry has outdone him and will have well over 200 before he leaves office. So, and also on that day, King, Brother King, who's not Esther, was one of the Angola Three.
Yeah.
Is going to be in Houston that day. He's going to be speaking at the Mickey Leland School at Texas Southern at 10 o'clock that morning. He's going to do a book reading, and there'll also be an excerpt from a play that Paul Neil Herbert has written about the Angola Three. And a few of us will be speaking that morning, and then King will come out to the hanging tree at 5 o'clock and speak at the rally.
Yeah, because that whole thing in Louisiana was about trees, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Tell me, what's going on tonight at Shape Center?
Tonight at Shape Center, there's a wonderful event taking place, and I actually spent yesterday afternoon with one of the Gina Six, a young man named Michael Bell. And he is going to be speaking, and this will be the first time he has ever given a public speech, because he is the one of the Gina Six that has been locked up. He was locked up for 2 years. And he got out last December, and he just graduated from high school. He's very proud of that. And he's looking forward to living his life not in Gina, Louisiana.
Well, Gloria, any reflections from you concerning the fact that Michael Riley was executed on the anniversary?
Well, it's interesting, and there's two African American guards standing right in front of me, and I wonder what they think about that. That Malcolm X's birthday is today. It's a day that.
Are you about to get arrested again?
No, I'm not. Okay. They're not even paying attention to me right now. In fact, that's maybe all. What do y'all think about somebody getting executed on Malcolm X's birthday? Are you not allowed to talk to me?
No, they're not going to make comments.
You told me to move a while ago. Now you don't want to talk to me.
They're not going to make comments.
Okay, Gloria, you can pull back the barbs and continue.
Pardon me? There's no comment from the two African-American prison correctional officers or whatever they are, Ben and Gray. But I think it's very insulting to any black person and then to anybody that loves Malcolm X. So
you don't have to be black to love Malcolm X.
No.
I memorized most of those speeches and found them very useful in a lot of reasons.
Oh, of course. Of course. He was a great thinker and analyzer and revolutionary. So, it's very insulting. And, you know, things have changed since the days of legal lynchings. I have a wonderful essay that one of the men on death row wrote about this. And he says, you know, there may not be strange fruit hanging from the trees in the town squares anymore, but they're being executed nonetheless. And, you know, the fact that black people can be dismissed from a jury at will, the fact that attorneys don't even talk to their clients before they go on trial, I mean, it's a different way of killing people.
Gloria, how do people get in touch with the abolition movement?
Abolition.movement@hotmail.com.
Abolition.movement@hotmail.com.
Abolition.movement@hotmail.com or 713-503-2633.
713-503-2633.
Right.
And every time there's an execution, unless you have serious conflict of schedule, you'll be there or here.
Yeah, I'll be in Huntsville.
Okay.
You know, Gloria, one day in the future when the death penalty is no more and people are looking at the history of it all, they're going to find that there are groups, especially in Texas, Harris County, Houston, that were very tenacious and who fought and resisted and protested for years and years to cause the death penalty to go away and to actually bring a real civilization
We have seen
city.
They would have executed Clarence Brantley, clearly.
Oh, they came close, very close.
If we had not organized.
It took 5 years of
and,
protest.
And sometimes organizing works and sometimes it don't. But Gloria, we're going to let you go.
Okay, well, thank you guys.
Be careful coming back. Give our regards to the other vigilants there.
I will.
And to the family.
Okay, I sure will. I'm actually going to hurry and leave Huntsville so I can get over to Shape Center because I'm one of the speakers. I was invited to go to the funeral home, but I'm gonna pass. They're going to have a memorial, though, Saturday in Quitman, and I may drive up for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Gloria Rubach, activist unlike anybody. As a matter of fact, I feel pretty overwhelmed because I'm in with Esther King. Esther and I have been on picket lines for about 40 years.
That's right.
Jim Skelton won honors from his peers in the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. He was granted the Aristotle Award at an event last week that I attended. And, the speeches giving him the award lasted about as long as Aristotle took to teach Alexander the Great. But Jim deserved the honor, and he is certainly an Aristotle-like figure in his profession. Esther, any thoughts?
Each time this event actually goes through, I'm always saddened. And I'm sad for people who actually feel somehow vindicated if a person dies, whether that person is innocent or guilty. You know, there was a time when when lynch law ruled Texas and other Absolutely. Southern states, that the people, the mobs who gathered and got into the framework and the frame of mind of having somebody die really didn't care if the right person, there were many victims who just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time when the mob was moving mm-hmm. And wound up hanging from trees to satisfy that need to kill. And so I sympathize with people who feel that, who sit down and watch TV or read the papers, and they don't know any of the people involved, but they feel somehow justice has been served, that they feel vindicated. Not a lot of people, because if I think there were many people out there who had the opportunity to personally vote as to whether somebody would be executed, at that moment would not be able to do that.
Dave Edwood, you've joined us?
Yes, I have, Ray.
Okay, David, where are you?
Corner of Fannin and Southmore at the First Unitarian, first in front of the First Unitarian
first
Church.
Okay. Do you have folks with you?
Yeah, we had about a dozen people there today. It was a fairly decent turnout. Not a big number, but, pretty good group. Had the pastor of the church came out. That's unusual.
Yeah.
And we had there was a film crew from Finland that was there today. These European countries are very interested in what goes on over here and sort of shocked and amazed by Texas in particular. So they had a film crew out there, which I guess they'll be taking back to film. They'll take some film back to Finland to show our protest.
Well, the witnesses are dispersing. Families going by the funeral home. Others are going headed back to the highways and home. They had about 7 or 8 people in Huntsville. Several members of the family were there, but they were in witnessing the execution.
Yeah.
Tell me, Dave, this is... Jim Skelton earlier in the show said that he did not think that this case would be tried as a capital case. 25 years ago, times were different. And in Houston, all of 2008, there was not a single execution case resolved with execution.
Yeah, not a death sentence given out, right?
Not a death sentence given out, which is very unusual.
Right.
Do you think the winds are blowing in a more favorable direction?
Well, I think that the people are, not the politicians necessarily, but the people I think are changing. I really do. They've seen too much, read too much, and they recognize that we do not have a perfect criminal justice system by any stretch of the imagination, and I think they're becoming more cautious about giving out the death sentences. And, there's been so much news. We had the problem with the crime lab. We've had, I think I saw on the computer today, the 133rd person exonerated from death row. It wasn't in Texas. It was in another state.
Yeah.
But, they read about these things, and they we have life without parole now. We have... a lot of people have received, there's been a lot of education that's done, and I think people are changing. It's a slow process, but I think it's happening. So I still have hope.
Any comment on this being the 199th execution by the governor?
Well, we're coming up to 200. That'll be a fellow, Terry Hankins, I guess his name is, on June 2nd. That'll be number 200 under Perry himself, and he's by far, exceeded what Bush did. We never thought that Bush would ever, his record would ever be exceeded, but
sure enough,
Perry has done it, and he'll be in the records books for that. Not a very good record, I would think, but you don't expect much more from him right now.
Well, even his supporters are finding him disappointing these days, not for the reasons that we do, but for other reasons. Tell us about Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Well, we're a large and growing organization. Ray. We have an office now and a couple of staff people up in Austin that have been very busy working on the legislature this year. We have groups in about, I think, at least 12 different cities in Texas now. And on days like today, there are vigils in many different cities taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just Houston. I mean, you know, it's going on in San Antonio and Austin and in Dallas. And so we're growing, and we've got a lot of very good people that are involved in the organization.
Well, the Law of Parties bill actually has cleared the House.
Right. Right.
What seemed to be the holdup in the Senate?
Well, the holdup was that at first, I don't know what the status as of today, but they didn't have anybody in the Senate that was going to sponsor it like we did in the House.
Hmm.
And we had, Terry Hodge and Harold Button were the sponsors in the House of Representatives.
Well, normally, I mean, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on legislation that doesn't look very long shot to happen. But the fact of the matter is the House has been the difficult problem and the Senate's been relatively easy. This bill, on the other hand, actually went through committee in the House with amazing speed.
Right.
And it's a relatively modest bill. It just says that we're going to take execution off the table in law of parties cases. Doesn't mean we're going to cut people loose because of law of parties. As Jim Apley pointed out, if you did that, you'd have to do something about Charles Manson and compensate him. And so, but the deal is that law of parties in actual execution potential, it's a worthy bill.
Right, right. Well, it seems like it's something that ought to go through both houses and be signed off by Perry, but I'm not sure Perry's going to sign off on it either.
Well,
that's another step.
He did grant clemency in a law of parties case.
Yep, but he didn't use the law of parties as his reason, if you recall.
Yeah.
He said it was because two people were tried at the same time. You know, he was very clear that's why he was...
It was confusing the issue because they were tried together.
Right, right, right. That was what he was saying. But all of us feel that, you know, it was Law Party's concern, that the real reason that he did it.
How do the people get in touch with the coalition?
The best way is just to go to our website, which is tcadp.org.
tcadp.org. And you're working in Austin and elsewhere, and you're concerned about issues like are before us today.
Right, absolutely.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, Ray, thank you.
Bye-bye.
You take care.
And that completes that cycle. And Jim?
Yes.
Where are we?
Well, I was going to mention one other thing. Missouri's having a big flap about their death penalty. As a matter of fact, there's a man that they're going to execute as an untriggered man in a murder case. And part of their investigation in Missouri on their death penalty statute, they discovered they had a doctor who was dyslexic and had some creative way on how he mixed the chemicals. He was kind of, you know, and you often wonder, you know, a guy goes to medical school for all these number of years, and how does he end up working on death row in Missouri mixing chemicals to kill people? So you wonder what kind of doctor you're dealing with to begin with. But nonetheless, even some of the real conservative Republicans are very concerned about the way the death penalty is carried out. And it's much like the same flap they had up in Chicago. And really the emphasis wasn't that the people don't commit acts that are heinous. The theory was that we just haven't figured out a way to be fair about it. And they're having a big, big controversy in Missouri now. And they're talking about maybe perhaps even abolishing the death penalty up there or declaring a moratorium. Mainly because they had a crazy doctor administering the drugs, and then they have a big controversy we're having here in Texas. Should you execute the so-called non-trigger man, the man that didn't pull the trigger?
Sure. And this is an issue that has been cooking for all of my life.
Sure.
One thing I can say is the propensity that brings us to this precipice is lessening. And I think that's a good sign. I don't know that I am as optimistic as Esther, that it will come the day in my lifetime when we'll be looking back and scratch our head and say, why the hell did we do that? But I do know that if we don't remember that we did it, some future generation will come up with a cockamamie idea. Why don't we try this? You know, I get along pretty well with TDCJ executives. They once had a fellow by the name of Peterman, and he and I, we mixed like gasoline and matches. We couldn't get in a room together without shouting at one another. But the one thing we agreed on is that we must preserve this history. So we were both big supporters of the prison museum, because we were absolutely committed that if we didn't preserve this history, somebody sometime further down the road is going to make the same damn fool mistakes that we're making. And we both agreed. His position was to defend a lot of the guys that I was complaining about, but we both agreed that it ain't working. And that's why we're here today. If I thought for a minute that there was some positive aspect of the capital punishment practice, I would consider that and consider changing my mind. But I don't see anything here.
You're not by yourself either, Ray, because just the fact that over the years in this country where it's been practiced and put into law, it's constantly backing up and changing. The method, for instance, because mm-hmm. that was a time when they hang people or they burn people in electric chairs, they shot people. And the fact that they keep trying to make it somehow, or you have the discussion, or the argument about the humaneness of it, means that you really can't square it with the under the moral code that you say you operate under, under the Judeo-Christian ethic that you say you operate, you can't square it. So you keep having to modify. The Supreme Court had a moratorium on it, and of course the fact that it's within the context of a historical set of circumstances whereby one group of people who suffer from it more than anybody else were held in bondage and actually outside the national family. And the fact that for a long time we could not be on juries, then we could not practice law or argue cases in court. And the other side of it, of course, is, and the media has a lot to do with this because the media sensationalizes. They capitalize on the putting out the news of that kind of shocking news. And so politicians are able to have a situation where if you rob a store, you're convicted of robbing a store, you kill a clerk or you kill somebody, you can get the death penalty. But then somebody like Bernard Madoff, who stole all that money, made off with all that money. And the people go through the slow death, people who've been wiped out, who would go into mental straits and then die agonizing deaths of being imbalanced because they lost everything. You know, somebody who was on a job and they sacrificed, they didn't spend money, they saved it, and they bought stock, and they got wiped out. And then they go into a pauper situation. But, of course, the law says, well, you know, that's white-collar crime. And we don't execute people for doing things like that. But the end result of those activities, although it's not a shocking and quick thing, it's the same. And and I know there are people who will argue the veracity of what I'm saying. But still.
Of course, you've never been afraid to argue anything,
exactly.
Esther King.
But certainly, Ray, I think that the fact that people still tamper with the rules of how it's going to be done means that they cannot morally stand on solid ground and call for it.
Look at the people in your life. I'm talking to you, the people listening to this show. I'm not talking to the folks in here because I know all these folks in here. But look at the people in your life. Look at the kids that so easily could get into trouble tomorrow.
Very easy.
What can you do now to prevent that? Get up ahead of it instead of behind it. You know, I dealt with parents in the prison show business. I deal with a lot of parents and wives. If a mother's nagging would prevent crime, they wouldn't be any criminals because their mamas have been on that for a long time. But a mother has no one to call for a son or a daughter that is going errant until somebody is in the hospital, in jail, or heaven forbid, the morgue. What we need to do is get ahead of these problems. Let's don't wait until the Michael Rileys have gone to the third or fourth or fifth juvenile court. Let's recognize that there is a problem here. And let's get some professional help. I mean, my God, what is happening to all those people that I see wearing mortarboards that are walking out of colleges, schools of social work, schools of psychology, schools of psychiatry, medical schools? What are happening? I mean, we've got all of these factories that are producing all of these professionals coming out of everywhere. And what are we doing? What is the responsibility of a lawyer who has a client that keeps getting into trouble and getting into trouble? At what point do you say, look, instead of meeting me at the courthouse, why don't we meet at the counselor's office? What's the matter with these people in education that see these problem children and put on blinders and walk away from it instead of toward it? What is the problem in this society of recognizing the value of every human life and the value of the quality of every human life? Because I can tell you right now, when you go to prison, and I've been there, you will adapt to that society, which is not good news, or you will not survive. If you don't adapt, you're not going to survive. And once you have adapted to that society, the big shock is whenever you walk out and you realize you're ill-prepared to adapt to this one.
Not only that, Ray, but you're cut off from so many opportunities when people say, well, you take this time to rehabilitate yourself and turn the page. But you're cut off from so many job opportunities, so many things you can't do. And in this highly competitive society, where you're competing with people who don't have records, people who may have college and you may have dropped out of high school, just the fact that there are many job opportunities that you absolutely can't have, you give up when you're convicted, means that your chances of being a recidivist are very great. And the community that would offer support to help you through is now so torn by poverty. And and they say, well, don't go back into the same circumstances that led you here. Well, where are you going to go?
Give me another alternative.
Where are you going to go?
And the fact that usually by the time someone gets to prison, their addiction and their other habits have estranged them from what little support they once had.
Sure.
Because your mothers only get their purse stolen so many times, and grandmothers only have to get their Social Security check stolen so many times to buy crack or buy other drugs. And what we're doing about crack and drugs is we're exacerbating the problem.
And, Ray, you know, that's a topic for another whole show.
Oh, absolutely.
The availability of, nobody. I've never run across, in all my travels to Texas, a poppy farm. I've never run across any big cocaine operations. So that stuff is coming in. It's being imported, and it's being imported with the help of some very powerful people. That's a topic for the availability of those drugs is a topic for another whole show, really.
Well, May the 19th, 2009, Michael Riley was executed.
On Malcolm X's birthday.
On Malcolm X's birthday. If you don't have anything to do this evening, you want to hear an interesting program by a young man learning to be an activist, Shape Center's got the show for you.
I'm on my way there.
No way to do it. I want to recognize the wonderful staff we've had. Of course, you just heard Esther King. Esther and I have been many picket lines together.
Many.
Organization, building of this radio station, and it's here for us to use, Mike. And he's serving on the board, one of them sucker jobs that I won't take anymore. Jim Skelton is with us tonight. Jim Skelton, we usually call him a legal analyst, but he's much more than that. Jim analyzes and anguishes over these cases. sends us advance notes so that I can make an announcement on the news that we're doing this. Jim Skelton received the award of his peers. Criminal defense lawyers gave him the Aristotle Award at the banquet last week. I was fortunate enough to be there. Even got my name rattled off from the podium. And the outgoing president thinks highly of some of my work. Of course, nothing is possible without the technical wizardry of Otis McClay. When Otis is down, we have to impose on the manager to come here and flip switches, and imposing on station managers to do that is asking a little much. Otis McClay is our engineer tonight, and we thank him for getting our voice to you. Elizabeth Ann Stein is, of course, the producer of this show, and she's the one that does most of the work and gets it all ready and puts it together, and we talk frequently, several times a day. And the theme music was written by Victoria Panetti, and Victoria's coming, did you say?
Some friends of hers are coming to town.
Some friends of hers are coming to town. I hope to coffee up and we can tell you more about her. Her brother or somebody is.
Scott Panetti is on death row,
and she writes this contemporary music, and it comes across that. My name is Ray Hill, and I do the prison show on radio station KPFD and have for the last 29 years. And it is an honor to be able to come in and do the sad duty that is required of this show. I give out my home telephone number on the prison show all the time, and when the phone rings, I often wish that I had better news for the callers. But I have learned to develop enough calluses in the places where you hurt to try to help those that I can and comfort those that I can't. The criminal justice system needs a lot of work. Join us on Friday night listening to the prison show and help us plan for that. I want to thank you for listening to KPFT HD2 channel Execution Watch. Join us on the website executionwatch.org. Good night.